Chapter 7. The rain had quit by the time I got home, and a late grin of moon had appeared over the ridges to the north. My sleepiness seemed to have gone with the clouds. I was wide awake, and I could smell Delacroix on me. I thought I might smell him on my skin. Barbecue me and you, stinky pinky, few few few. For a long time to come. Janice was waiting up, as she always did on execution nights. I meant not to tell her the story, saw no sense in harrowing her with it. But she got a clear look at my face as I came in the kitchen door, and would have it all. So I sat down, took her warm hands in my cold ones. The heater in my old Ford barely worked, and the weather had turned 180 degrees since the storm, and told her what she thought she wanted to hear. About halfway through, I broke down crying, which I hadn't expected. I was a little ashamed, but only a little. It was her, you see, and she never taxed me with the times that I slipped from the way I thought a man should be. The way I thought I should be, at any rate. A man with a good wife is the luckiest of God's creatures, and one without must be among the most miserable, I think, the only true blessing of their lives that they don't know how poorly off they are. I cried, and she held my head against her breast, and when my own storm passed, I felt better. A little, anyway. And I believe that was when I had the first conscious sight of my idea. Not the shoe. I don't mean that. The shoe was related, but different. All my real idea was right then, however, was an odd realization. That John Coffey and Melinda Moores, different as they might have been in size and sex and color, had exactly the same eyes. Woeful, sad, and distant, dying eyes. "Come to bed," my wife said at last. "Come to bed with me, Paul." So I did, and we made love. And when it was over, she went to sleep. As I lay there, watching the moon grin and listening to the walls tick, they were at last pulling in, exchanging summer for fall, I thought about John Coffey saying he had helped it. "I helped Dell's mouse. I helped Mr. Jingles. He's a circus mouse." Sure. And maybe I thought we were all circus mice, running around with only the dimmest awareness that God and all his heavenly host were watching us in our Bakelite houses through our ivy glass windows. I slept a little as the day began to lighten, 2 hours, I guess, maybe three, and I slept the way I always sleep these days here at Georgia Pines, and hardly ever did then, in thin little licks. What I went to sleep thinking about was the churches of my youth. The names changed, depending on the whims of my mother and her sisters, but they were all really the same. All the First Backwoods Church of Praise Jesus the Lord is Mighty. In the shadow of those blunt square steeples, the concept of atonement came up as regularly as the toll of the bell which called the faithful to worship. Only God could forgive sins, could and did, washing them away in the agonal blood of his crucified Son, but that did not change the responsibility of his children to atone for those sins and even their simple errors of judgment whenever possible. Atonement was powerful. It was the lock on the door you closed against the past. I fell asleep, thinking of Piney Woods' atonement, and Edouard Delacroix on fire as he rode the lightning, and Melinda Moores, and my big boy with the endlessly weeping eyes. These thoughts twisted their way into a dream. In it, John Coffey was sitting on a river bank and bawling his inarticulate mooncalf's grief up at the early summer sky, while on the other bank a freight train stormed endlessly toward a rusty trestle spanning the Trepingus. In the crook of each arm, the black man held the body of a naked, blonde-haired girl-child. His fists, huge brown rocks at the ends of those arms, were closed. All around him crickets chirred, and no seams flocked. The day hummed with heat. In my dream, I went to him, knelt before him, and took his hands. His fists relaxed and gave up their secrets. In one was a spool, colored green and red and yellow. In the other was a prison guard's shoe.
"I couldn't help it,"
John Coffey said.
"I tried to take it back, but it was too late."
And this time, in my dream, I understood him. Chapter 8. At 9 o'clock the next morning, while I was having a third cup of coffee on the porch, my wife said nothing, but I could see disapproval writ large on her face when she brought it to me, the telephone rang. I went into the parlor to take it, and Central told someone that their party was holding the line. She then told me to have a birdlarky day and rang off, presumably. With Central, you could never quite tell for sure. Hal Moores's voice shocked me. Wavery and hoarse, it sounded like the voice of an octogenarian. It occurred to me that it was good that things had gone all right with Curtis Anderson in the tunnel last night, good that he felt about the same as we did about Percy, because this man I was talking to would very likely never work another day at Cold Mountain. "Paul, I understand there was trouble last night. I also understand that our friend Mr. Wetmore was involved." "A spot of trouble," I admitted, holding the receiver tight to my ear and leaning in toward the horn. "But the job got done, that's the important thing." "Yes, of course." "Can I ask who told you? So I can tie a can to his tail," I didn't add. "You can ask, but since it's really none of your beeswax, I think I'll keep my mouth shut on that score. But when I called my office to see if there were any messages or urgent business, I was told an interesting thing."
"Oh?"
"Yes. Seems a transferral application landed in my basket. Percy Wetmore wants to go to Briar Ridge as soon as possible. Must have filled out the application even before last night's shift was over, wouldn't you think?"
"It sounds that way," I agreed.
"Ordinarily, I'd let Curtis handle it, but considering the atmosphere on E-Block just lately, I asked Hannah to run it over to me personally on her lunch hour. She has graciously agreed to do so. I'll approve it and see it's forwarded on to the state capitol this afternoon. I expect you'll get a look at Percy's backside going out the door no more than a month, maybe less."
He expected me to be pleased with this news, and had a right to expect it. He had taken time out from tending his wife to expedite a matter that might otherwise have taken upwards of half a year, even with Percy's vaunted connections. Nevertheless, my heart sank. A month. But maybe it didn't matter much, one way or the other. It removed a perfectly natural desire to wait and put off a risky endeavor, and what I was now thinking about would be very risky indeed. Sometimes, when that's the case, it's better to jump before you can lose your nerve. If we were going to have to deal with Percy in any case, always assuming I could get the others to go along with my insanity, always assuming there was a we, in other words, it might as well be tonight.
"Paul? Are you there?"
His voice lowered a little, as if he thought he was now talking to himself.
"Damn, I think I lost the connection."
"No, I'm here, Al. That's great news."
"Yes,"
he agreed, and I was again struck by how old he sounded, how papery, somehow.
"Oh, I know what you're thinking."
No, you don't, Warden, I thought. Never in a million years could you know what I'm thinking.
You're thinking that our young friend will still be around for the coffee execution. That's probably true. Coffee will go well before Thanksgiving, I imagine. But you can put him back in the switch room. No one will object, including him, I should think.
I'll do that, I said. How's Melinda? There was a long pause. So long I might have thought I'd lost him, except for the sound of his breathing. When he spoke this time, it was in a much lower tone of voice.
She's sinking, he said.
Sinking. That chilly word the old-timers used not to describe a person who was dying, exactly, but one who had begun to uncouple from living.
The headache seemed a little better, for now, anyway, but she can't walk without help, she can't pick things up, she loses control of her water while she sleeps.
There was another pause, and then in an even lower voice, Hal said something that sounded like, "She wears."
"Wears what, Hal?" I asked, frowning.
My wife had come into the parlor doorway. She stood there wiping her hands on a dish towel and looking at me.
"No," he said, in a voice that seemed to waver between anger and tears. "She swears."
"Oh." I still didn't know what he meant, but had no intention of pursuing it. I didn't have to. He did it for me.
"She'll be all right. Perfectly normal, talking about her flower garden, or a dress she saw in the catalog, or maybe about how she heard Roosevelt on the radio and how wonderful he sounds. And then all at once she'll start to say the most awful things, the most awful words. She doesn't raise her voice. It would almost be better if she did, I think, because then, you see, then
she wouldn't sound so much like herself."
"That's it," he said gratefully. "But to hear her saying those awful gutter-language things in her sweet voice—" "Pardon me, Paul."
His voice trailed away, and I heard him noisily clearing his throat. Then he came back, sounding a little stronger, but just as distressed.
"She wants to have Pastor Donaldson over, and I know he's a comfort to her, but how can I ask him? Suppose that he's sitting there reading scripture with her, and she calls him a foul name. She could. She called me one last night. She said, 'Hand me that Liberty magazine, you cocksucker, would you?' Paul, where could she have ever heard such language? How could she know those words?"
"I don't know. Hal, are you going to be home this evening?" When he was well and in charge of himself, not distracted by worry or grief, Hal Moore's had a cutting and sarcastic facet to his personality. His subordinates feared that side of him even more than his anger or his contempt, I think. His sarcasm, usually impatient and often harsh, could sting like acid. A little of that now splashed on me. It was unexpected, but on the whole I was glad to hear it. All the fight hadn't gone out of him after all, it seemed.
"No," he said, "I'm taking Melinda out square dancing. We're going to do-si-do, Alamand left, and then tell the fiddler he's a rooster-dick motherfucker."
I clapped my hand over my mouth to keep from laughing. Mercifully, it was an urge that passed in a hurry.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I haven't been getting much sleep lately. It's made me grouchy." "Of course we're going to be home. Why do you ask?"
"It doesn't matter, I guess," I said.
"You weren't thinking of coming by, were you? Because if you were on last night, you'll be on tonight, unless you've switched with somebody."
"No, I haven't switched," I said. "I'm on tonight."
"It wouldn't be a good idea anyway. Not the way she is right now."
"Maybe not. Thanks for your news."
"You're welcome. Pray for my Melinda, Paul."
I said I would, thinking that I might do quite a bit more than pray. God helps those who help themselves, as they say in the Church of Praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty. I hung up and looked at Janice.
"How's Melly?" she asked.
"Not good. I told her what Hal had told me, including the part about the swearing, although I left out cocksucker and rooster dick motherfucker. I finished with Hal's word, sinking, and Jan nodded sadly. Then she took a closer look at me. "What are you thinking about? You're thinking about something, probably no good. It's in your face." Lying was out of the question. It wasn't the way we were with each other. I just told her it was best she not know, at least for the time being.
"Is it... could it get you in trouble?"
She didn't sound particularly alarmed at the idea, more interested than anything, which is one of the things I have always loved about her. "Maybe," I said.
"Is it a good thing?"
"Maybe," I repeated. I was standing there, still turning the phone's crank idly with one finger while I held down the connecting points with a finger of my other hand.
"Would you like me to leave you alone while you use the telephone?" she asked. "Be a good little woman and butt out, do some dishes, knit some booties?"
I nodded. "That's not the way I'd put it, but
are we having extras for lunch, Paul?"
"I hope so," I said. Chapter 9. I got Brutal and Dean right away because both of them were on the exchange. Harry wasn't, not then at least, but I had the number of his closest neighbor who was. Harry called me back about 20 minutes later, highly embarrassed at having to reverse the charges and sputtering promises to pay his share when our next bill came. I told him we'd count those chickens when they hatched. In the meantime, could he come over to my place for lunch? Brutal and Dean would be here, and Janice had promised to put out some of her famous slaw, not to mention her even more famous apple pie.
"Lunch just for the hell of it?"
Harry sounded skeptical. I admitted I had something I wanted to talk to them about, but it was best not gone into even lightly over the phone. Harry agreed to come. I dropped the receiver onto the prongs, went to the window, and looked out thoughtfully. Although we'd had the late shift, I hadn't awakened either Brutal or Dean, and Harry hadn't sounded like a fellow freshly turned out of dreamland either. It seemed that I wasn't the only one having problems with what had happened last night. And considering the craziness I had in mind, that was probably good. Brutal, who lived closest to me, arrived at 11:15. Dean showed up 15 minutes later, and Harry, already dressed for work, about 15 minutes after Dean. Janice served us cold beef sandwiches, slaw, and iced tea in the kitchen. Only a day before, we would have had it out on the side porch and been glad of a breeze, but the temperature had dropped a good 15 degrees since the thunderstorm, and a keen-edged wind was snuffling down from the ridges. "You're welcome to sit down with us," I told my wife. She shook her head.
"I don't think I want to know what you're up to. I'll worry less if I'm in the dark. I'll have a bite in the parlor. I'm visiting with Miss Jane Austen this week, and she's very good company."
"Who's Jane Austen?" Harry asked when she had left. "Your side or Janice's, Paul? A cousin? Is she pretty?"
"She's all right, you nit," Brutal told him. "Been dead practically since Betsy Ross basted the stars on the first flag."
"Oh," Harry looked embarrassed. "I'm not much of a reader. Radio manuals, mostly."
"What's on your mind, Paul?" Dean asked. "John Coffey and Mr. Jingles, to start with." They looked surprised, which I had expected. They'd been thinking I wanted to discuss either Delacroix or Percy, maybe both. I looked at Dean and Harry. The thing with Mr. Jingles, what Coffey did, happened pretty fast. I don't know if he got there in time to see how broken up the mouse was or not. Dean shook his head.
"I saw the blood on the floor, though."
I turned to Brutal.
"That son of a bitch Percy crushed it," he said simply. "It should have died, but it didn't. Coffey did something to it. Healed it somehow. I know how that sounds, but I saw it with my own eyes."
I said, "He healed me as well. And I didn't just see it. I felt it." I told them about my urinary infection. how it had come back, how bad it had been. I pointed through the window at the woodpile I'd had to hold on to the morning the pain drove me to my knees, and how it had gone away completely after coffee touched me, and stayed away. It didn't take long to tell. When I was done, they sat and thought about it a while, chewing on their sandwiches as they did. Then Dean said,
"Black things came out of his mouth. Like bugs."
"That's right," Harry agreed. "They were black to start with, anyway. Then they turned white and disappeared."
He looked around, considering.
"It's like I damn near forgot the whole thing until you brought it up, Paul. Ain't that funny?"
"Nothing funny or strange about it," Brutal said. "I think that's what people most always do with the stuff they can't make out. Just forget it. Doesn't do a person much good to remember stuff that doesn't make any sense. What about it, Paul? Were there bugs when he fixed you?"
"Yes. I think they're the sickness, the pain, the hurt. He takes it in and lets it out into the open air again."
"Where it dies," Harry said.
I shrugged. I didn't know if it died or not. Wasn't sure it even mattered.
"Did he suck it out of you?" Brutal asked. "He looked like he was sucking it right out of the mouth. The hurt, the, you know, the death."
"No," I said. "He just touched me. And I felt it. A kind of jolt, like electricity, only not painful. But I wasn't dying, only hurting." Brutal nodded.
"The touch and the breath. Just like you hear those backwoods gospel shouters going on about."
"Praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty," I said.
"I don't know if Jesus comes into it," Brutal said, "but it seems to me like John Coffey is one mighty man."
"All right," Dean said. "If you say all this happened, I guess I believe it. God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. But what's it got to do with us?"
Well, that was the big question, wasn't it? I took in a deep breath and told them what I wanted to do. They listened, dumbfounded. Even Brutal, who liked to read those magazines with the stories about little green men from space, looked dumbfounded. There was a longer silence when I finished this time, and no one chewing any sandwiches. At last, in a gentle and reasonable voice, Brutus Howell said, "We'd lose our jobs if we were caught, Paul. And we'd be very goddamn lucky if that was all that happened. We'd probably end up over in A Block as guests of the state, making wallets and showering in pairs."
"Yes," I said, "that could happen."
"I can understand how you feel a little," he went on. "You know Moore's better than us. He's your friend as well as the big boss, and I know you think a lot of his wife."
"She's the sweetest woman you could ever hope to meet," I said. "And she means the world to him."
"But we don't know her the way you and Janice do," Brutal said. "Do we, Paul?"
"You'd like her if you did," I said. "At least you'd like her if you'd met her before this thing got its claws into her. She does a lot of community things. She's a good friend, and she's religious. More than that, she's funny. Used to be, anyhow. She could tell you things that'd make you laugh until the tears rolled down your cheeks. But none of those things are the reason I want to help save her, if she can be saved. What's happening to her is an offense, goddammit, an offense to the eyes and the ears and the heart.
Very noble. But I doubt like hell if that's what put this bee in your bonnet," Brutal said. "I think it's what happened to Dell. You want to balance it off somehow."
And he was right. Of course he was. I knew Melinda Moore's better than the others did, but maybe not, in the end, well enough to ask them to risk their jobs for her, and possibly their freedom as well. Or my own job and freedom, for that matter. I had two grown children, and the last thing on God's earth that I wanted my wife to have to do was to write them the news that their father was going on trial for, well, what would it be? I didn't know for sure. Aiding and abetting an escape attempt seemed the most likely. But the death of Edouard Delacroix had been the ugliest, foulest thing I had ever seen in my life.
Not just my working life, but my whole entire life, and I had been a party to it. We had all been a party to it, because we had allowed Percy Wetmore to stay even after we knew he was horribly unfit to work in a place like E-Block. We had played the game. Even Warden Moore's had been a party to it. His nuts are going to cook whether Wetmore's on the team or not, he had said, and maybe that was well enough, considering what the little Frenchman had done. But in the end, Percy had done a lot more than cook Dell's nuts. He had blown the little man's eyeballs right out of their sockets and set his damned face on fire. And why? Because Dell was a murderer half a dozen times over? No. Because Percy had wet his pants, and the little Cajun had had the temerity to laugh at him. We'd been part of a monstrous act, and Percy was going to get away with it. Off to Briar Ridge he would go, happy as a clam at high tide, and there he would have a whole asylum filled with lunatics to practice his cruelties upon. There was nothing we could do about that, but perhaps it was not too late to wash some of the muck off our own hands. "In my church they call it atonement instead of balancing," I said. "But I guess it comes to the same thing." "Do you really think coffee could save her?" Dean asked in a soft, awed voice. "Just, what, suck that brain tumor out of her head like it was a peach pit?" "I think he could. It's not for sure, of course, but after what he did to me and to Mr. Jingles." "That mouse was seriously busted up, all right," Brutal said.
"But would he do it?" Harry mused. "Would he?"
"If he can, he will," I said.
"Why? Coffee doesn't even know her."
"Because it's what he does. It's what God made him for." Brutal made a show of looking around, reminding us all that someone was missing.
"What about Percy? You think he's just going to let this go down?" he asked.
And so I told them what I had in mind for Percy. By the time I finished, Harry and Dean were looking at me in amazement, and a reluctant grin of admiration had dawned on Brutal's face.
"Pretty audacious, Brother Paul," he said. "Fair takes my breath away. But wouldn't it be the bee's knees?" Dean almost whispered, then laughed aloud and clapped his hands like a child. "I mean vo-do-de-o-do in 23 skidoo!"
You want to remember that Dean had a special interest in the part of my plan that involved Percy. Percy could have gotten Dean killed, after all, freezing up the way he had.
"Yeah, but what about after?" Harry said.
He sounded gloomy, but his eyes gave him away. They were sparkling, the eyes of a man who wants to be convinced.
"What then?"
"They say dead men tell no tales," Brutal rumbled, and I took a quick look at him to make sure he was joking.
"I think he'll keep his mouth shut," I said.
"Really?"
Dean looked skeptical. He took off his glasses and began to polish them.
"Convince me."
"First, he won't know what really happened. He's going to judge us by himself and think it was just a prank. Second, and more important, he'll be afraid to say anything. That's what I'm really counting on. We tell him that if he starts writing letters and making phone calls, we start writing letters and making phone calls."
"About the execution," Harry said.
"And about the way he froze when Wharton attacked Dean," Brutal said. "I think people finding out about that is what Percy Wetmore's really afraid of." He nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
"It could work.
But, Pa, wouldn't it make more sense to bring Mrs. Moore's to Coffee than Coffee to Mrs. Moore's? We could take care of Percy pretty much the way you laid it out, then bring her in through the tunnel instead of taking Coffee out that way."
I shook my head. "Never happen. Not in a million years."
"Because of Warden Moore's?"
"That's right. He's so hard-headed he makes old Doubting Thomas look like Joan of Arc. If we bring Coffee to his house, I think we can surprise him into at least letting Coffee make the try. Otherwise..."
"What were you thinking about using for a vehicle?" Brutal asked.
"My first thought was the stagecoach,"
I said, but we'd never get it out of the yard without being noticed, and everyone within a 20-mile radius knows what it looks like anyway. I guess maybe we can use my Ford.
Guess again, Dean said, popping his specs back onto his nose. You couldn't get John Coffey into your car if you stripped him naked, covered him with lard, and used a shoehorn. You're so used to looking at him that you've forgotten how big he is.
I had no reply to that. Most of my attention that morning had been focused on the problem of Percy and the lesser but not inconsiderable problem of Wild Bill Wharton. Now I realized that transportation wasn't going to be as simple as I had hoped. Harry Terwilliger picked up the remains of his second sandwich, looked at it for a second, then put it down again.
"If we was to actually do this crazy thing," he said, "I guess we could use my pickup truck. Sit him in the back of that. Wouldn't be nobody much on the roads at that hour. We're talking about well after midnight, ain't we?"
"Yes," I said.
"You guys are forgetting one thing," Dean said. "I know Coffee's been pretty quiet ever since he came on the block. Doesn't do much but lay there on his bunk and leak from the eyes, but he's a murderer. Also, he's huge. If he decided he wanted to escape out of the back of Harry's truck, the only way we could stop him would be to shoot him dead. And a guy like that would take a lot of killing, even with a .45. Suppose we weren't able to put him down. And suppose he killed someone else. I'd hate losing my job, and I'd hate going to jail. I got a wife and kids depending on me to put bread in their mouths, but I don't think I'd hate either of those things near as much as having another dead little girl on my conscience."
"That won't happen," I said.
"How in God's name can you be so sure of that?"
I didn't answer. I didn't know just how to begin. I had known this would come up. Of course I did, but I still didn't know how to start telling them what I knew. Brutal helped me.
"You don't think he did it, do you, Paul?"
He looked incredulous.
"You think that big lug is innocent?"
"I'm positive he's innocent," I said.
"How in the name of Jesus can you be?"
"There are two things," I said. "One of them is my shoe." I leaned forward over the table and began talking.